Good evening and welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Edward Hauer. Hauer is the author of 9 books, including Shadows and Elephants, A Garden of Demons, and his most recent, The Storms of May. He has traveled and lived all over the world and gives writing workshops in places like Greece, Nepal, and Britain. He's also on staff part-time at Ithaca College. Welcome to the show, Edward.
Thank you.
It's so nice to have you here.
Well, I'm glad to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
You know, you have a very interesting artist statement posted on your website, and it begins with the line, "When I was 15, a film of one of Tennessee Williams's plays changed my life." Tell me about that.
Well, I went to see The Rose Tattoo. I came from a rather affluent suburb, which was rather odorless and colorless, and I suddenly saw real people who were shouting and crying and carrying on. It was a very sensuous film, and it somehow got to me, and I wanted to create people like the ones in the film. And the people I knew in that town seemed odorless and colorless then, and I somehow knew I was different from them. And it was the first sort of intimation I had that I was going to write and to be different and not have the sort of lives that the people I knew had and the kind of life my parents wanted for me.
Hmm. Yeah, you do sort of describe a repressive childhood, but it sounds like one of privilege. Well, what was it that you didn't like about it, the repression part?
I don't know. It was a privileged childhood, but my parents didn't get on well, and I was, like a lot of young people, I couldn't wait to get out of town. And I went to Cornell, and from there I went to Africa for 3 years. I had to go halfway around the world to get away from my childhood.
Get away from your neighborhood.
This is not uncommon for writers and artists to have to leave town in a hurry they get to be a certain age and go out and experience different things that you can't find in a small town.
Uh-huh. And so you went to East Africa, and my understanding is that you taught high school and sang in local nightclubs.
Yeah.
Tell us about that. How did you incorporate yourself into that community so quickly?
Well, I was a high school teacher, and I could play the guitar. I had played in coffee shops in Greenwich Village in the early 60s. I once appeared on the same stage with Bob Dylan.
Really?
In Gerdes Folk City. This was amateur night. He knew 3 chords, and I knew 3 chords in those days. But anyway, I was the only person in the whole Republic of Kenya who had a 12-string guitar, and I could sing. And there was the Russians had just given the government of Kenya a television studio, and they needed people to use it. So anybody that could sing or make any kind of noise was invited for Sunday Star Time. And I would show up and sing country western songs quite a lot. And then I backed some local African singers, and there were some South Africans there who sang in Zulu and Xhosa, and I backed them with my guitar. In between numbers, in between shows, they focused the camera on a goldfish bowl. And a friend of mine played classical music while they were setting up for the next show. So for maybe 5, 10, 15, 20 minutes, viewers got to watch goldfish and listen to Chopin. And then they would cut the goldfish and the Chopin and get on to the next Swahili news broadcast or whatever it was.
How interesting.
That was Voice of Kenya Television back in the early days. And I was the star, one of many stars of Sunday Star Time, along with a high school band of Indian students who played Beatles hits and all looked like the Beatles, if Indian kids can look like the Beatles.
What kind of songs did you play? Can you remember any of the titles?
I played country western songs.
What were they?
Jim Reeves was a very popular singer. He'll Have to Go.
Oh.
Hank Williams songs were popular. Mm-hmm. And folk songs, the kind of American folk songs that I had sung in Greenwich Village during the folk years.
But you never thought about going into music as a career, huh?
Not seriously. I got back to New York, and everybody was a lot better than I was. And I knew that I was going to be a writer or a singer. I wasn't going to be able to do both because they're just very, very demanding.
Yeah.
And I knew I wanted to be a writer since I was about 13. And unlike Bob Dylan, who knew he wanted to be a singer and forever and accumulated, you know, his songs and his experiences and that in that direction.
Mm-hmm. And in that form as well.
Yeah. I just finished reading his Chronicles.
Yes,
it's
wasn't
the same
that great?
Years that you know, I knew him and those people on McDougal Street and so forth.
That's an interesting book. I actually read that too.
Yeah.
Now you've traveled extensively, and a lot of your travel has been incorporated into your writing. Did travel lead you to write, or was it the other way around?
Writing before I started to travel, but mostly just in school. And so I think writing and travel were very closely connected for me. When I got to East Africa, I had to absorb absolutely everything, and I had to absorb it. I found myself writing 10 or 20 single-space pages a day of journal on my typewriter. I just had to record everything that was mm-hmm. going on. It seemed like I had to do it, and I knew one day I would write about it. And being in other countries has always sort of inspired me to write more than in this country in a way. It's new. I love new experiences.
Do you feel like you can be yourself more in a foreign country? Because I have felt that. I have traveled a bit myself. And you can. You can almost reinvent yourself if you want to as well.
It's true. You can reinvent yourself. And when you're 22, that's what you absolutely need to do. And I've done it again and again. It's a lot of fun. Nobody knows what on earth you are or who you are, and they have no expectations of what you're supposed to be like. And you can get away with a lot of just by being a foreigner.
Mm-hmm. And you can almost turn your life into fiction as well, right?
Well, sometimes it feels like you're living in a novel, yeah, and especially if you're, I don't know, you find yourself in situations. I was doing a piece for a newspaper, and we went up the Niger River in West Africa mm-hmm. on a motorized canoe and spent the day in villages doing healthcare work, and I was just doing, doing a reporter. But it seemed like this was fantastic voyage. The houses were all made of mud. They were in the shape of mosques, sort of. And the river boat would arrive at the village, and everybody would come out singing and dancing on the shore. It was extraordinary. It's the sort of thing I had read about in fiction.
Mm-hmm. Do you think it's important for anyone embarking on a career as a novelist to get out of academia and travel and see the world?
Or
can imagination just do it?
Yeah. I think it's important for most people. There are some people who just stay home and write at Eudora Welty, and that's wonderful if they can do it. But even she went on. She went all over Mississippi with her camera taking pictures and learning what it was like. So, yeah, people have to get away from what's familiar and what's comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
I think just about all of my books have been written out of situations which were sort of painful and uncomfortable for me because they're the most intense.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about some of your books. I was fascinated by A Garden of Demons, and it took place in Sri Lanka from the perspective of a half-American, half-Sri Lankan girl. Tell us about this. You lived there as well, and how much is this akin to your experience?
Well, I never actually lived in Sri Lanka, but I had good friends who had a rubber estate, and I spent several long visits with them, maybe a total of 4 or 5 months, and just got to know this one area. The war had not got to that part of the country, but I often spoke to people who had been in the war or who had been victims of some sort of violence connected with the tension between the Sinhalese people and the Tamil people, which is still going on today, tragically. It's the most beautiful country I've ever seen. It's one of the saddest, too. It could be extremely prosperous, but at any rate, I loved the place where I was staying and the people I was with, and this book came out of it. The girl in it is a little bit like the girl in the family. She's a little bit like my daughter at that age. She's a little bit like a girl that age I knew in Kenya, who also lived on a farm isolated out in the country. So she was a composite of several people.
Mm-hmm. A very creative little girl she was in this book as well.
Mm-hmm. It gave me a chance. She was an artist, and whenever I wanted to stick in a metaphor, I realized I couldn't do that from a child's point of view. But if I made her a painter, then I could do it. And this became a kind of trope which went through the book.
Mm-hmm.
So that was me allowing myself to use figurative language from a child's point of view. It was the only way I could figure out how that could be done.
Mm-hmm. And to tell us a little bit about the story, her father
Well, her father thinks he's running a nature sanctuary. But in fact, he's just sort of pottering around. And the nature sanctuary is mostly in his head. And the uncle who arrives there can see that because he comes from outside. The little girl can sort of see it too, but she wants to go along with her father and be nice. And so does the mother. But as he's planning on importing giraffes from Africa, meanwhile, the war is getting closer and closer mm-hmm. to his place, which he's not taking very good care of, and the rubber crop is being stolen, and the workers are running away, and the guerrillas, I don't say which ones, are using his land to accumulate weapons and old outbuildings mm-hmm. and so forth.
And it's amazing how the little girl uses this whole atmosphere to bring out her own creativity. And that's how she hides and survives in some ways.
Yeah. Well, she feels very anxious about this, but she's not quite sure why she does. She can tell that local people don't like her father very much. Mm-hmm. She can tell that her uncle is uneasy about the war coming closer. So she draws pictures of dangerous, frightening events as a way of quieting her own anxieties.
Mm-hmm. It's almost like a visual diary.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Did you get any reviews from your people that you knew in Sri Lanka?
I didn't. You know, I didn't want to send them the book. Eventually, I sent a copy after they left Sri Lanka. But they don't read fiction very much. I'm not sure they read it.
Uh-huh. Well, your most recent book is The Storms of May, and I found that one fascinating as well. It takes place mostly in a group home for troubled girls. To tell us more.
Well, I spent 5 years working for the New York State Division for Youth, as it was then called, with troubled teenagers in reform schools, in group homes like the one in the book. I came to Ithaca originally in 1973 to work out at South Lansing Center, which now has another name as well. It's a state school for that time only for girls. I worked in a boys' facility in the Catskills. The home in the Storms of May was one that my former wife and I ran. It was like that. The girls are composites, and the couple is also pretty much made up. But we had some adventures with these kids. I mean, they were real toughies sometimes, and they got in all kinds of trouble. And we had to go bail them out, and they brought incredible, terrible boyfriends into the house, and we had to keep them out of trouble while they stayed in school and had jobs after school. And the idea was that if we could do that, they could live normal lives. They wouldn't have to be incarcerated for the fairly petty things that they'd been caught for. And in fact, they all did get through the program. And I don't think any of them went to college, but they became, they got jobs. One of them became a policewoman, actually.
Mm-hmm. So it was a success for the most part, huh?
I think it was, yeah. Mm-hmm. yeah. Mm-hmm. And there were some that dropped out, and I don't know what happened to them. You never do.
So in what capacity did you work in these arenas? Were you like the house father?
I was the house father. My former wife was the house mother, mm-hmm. and we were supposed to behave like parents, except we had seven kids. We had three black kids and three white kids and one American Indian kid. And naturally, they didn't always get along. And we also had group encounter sessions, group therapy sessions every day. And we tried to run it like a normal home. Mm-hmm. My wife taught the kids how to cook. And we have to keep after them to keep their rooms clean, the usual sort of things.
Mm-hmm. Were you able to navigate in the community in regard to like racism and issues that might have come up for these children?
Yeah,
of color?
We were on a street, and we're to the right of the house was all white, and to the left was all black, and we were sort of the buffer zone. So people were kind of glad we were there. But there were riots at the high school every spring, and one of them is in the book, and they were race riots, and the white kids and the black kids went at each other. And they had a rather good time doing it. And the cops would wade in. And this was a very strongly Italian community. And they would just beat the hell out of the black kids and pound them with nightsticks and shove them into the back of the police car and take them off. The white kids were sort of pushed out of the way. And so I became, an advocate for police reform. I went to meetings of concerned black parents. And I had to explain how I had three black kids. And there was a lot of racism in this town. I won't name it, but it was one of the issues we had to deal with.
You are listening to Out of Bounds on WEOS. I'm Tish Perlman, and my guest is writer Edward Hauer. We're talking about his most current book, The Storms of May. The character Ruth in the book, who is the main character, is that a little bit like you or a little bit like your wife? And
well,
she's struggling in some ways to find her place.
I pretty much invented her. I think she's not at all like my former wife. as Flaubert says, Madame Bovary, c'est moi. All the characters in the book have a little bit of me in them. But she kind of took off on her own once I put her in the first person. I was struggling along with the book and not knowing how to separate fiction from what really happened. And what really happened can get in your way when you're trying to write a novel. Mm-hmm. And as soon as I invented Ruth, the narrator, who's a young woman in her late 20s, who's had a background not too unlike some of the girls. She's been in trouble herself with the police. As soon as I invented her, I was able to take the story completely into fiction because she was a fictionalized character. Mm-hmm. So I think writers do have trouble separating fact from fiction, and the temptation is to make it like it really was, and that can be quite boring. What your job is to write a novel. And
yeah.
So I ended up making up a lot of stuff. Just about all of the mm-hmm. material in the book was made up, although the atmosphere and of these kids in the house was pretty close to what it was uh-huh. like.
That experience must have touched you deeply, because you've written two books now. Your book, Wolf Tickets, was about a group home too, wasn't it?
It was
one
about
of
a reform
ones?
School, which was based uh-huh. on South Lansing Center. And uh-huh. what often happens in my books, the physical layout of the book is almost exactly like the real one. But then what goes on in the book is made up. I was at South Lansing Center for about a year and a half. And that was an explosive time there, and there were riots, and there were a lot of troubles there. And I eventually got fed up with it and fed up with myself doing a bad job protecting these kids from each other and left. But it was a very intense period in my life. So I wrote about things sort of like what happened when I was there, but I invented a main character again.
I know you got a degree in anthropology at UCLA, and you worked with Los Angeles street gangs. And have you ever thought about putting that into a book, that experience?
I don't think so. It's sort of a background material for a book I'm working on now, but I was pretty much concentrating the anthropology aspect of it. I never did become an anthropologist. I left after a master's degree, but the work was useful to me when I went to India, and I collected folk tales in rural villages outside of Jaipur when I was on a Fulbright grant there. And I was able to do field work and to put some of my training to use during that period.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And your book, Shadows and Elephants, was about a spiritualist, a mystic from Russia. Tell us about that book. I know a lot of people who have read that book and have found it fascinating.
Well, thank you. It's also came out of my Indian experience on my second Fulbright. I was living around the corner from what turned out to be the headquarters of the Theosophical Society, which began in the 19th century in New York, actually. I didn't know any of this. The founders were Madame Blavatsky, a Russian mystic, and her American partner, though not lover really, Colonel Henry Alcott, a Civil War veteran. Spiritualism was very popular in the 19th century. Mm-hmm. People wanted to get in touch with their relatives who had passed on to the other world. After the Civil War, there was a great surge of interest in it because so many people had died. So it seemed like a fascinating subject to me. What was this American and this Russian doing in India, who they had in the 19th century lived right around the corner from me?
Wow.
And so I became fascinated with this. And during my research, I went back there, and I was became a member of the Theosophical Society. I was allowed to do research on the grounds in their archives and their libraries. And Madame Blavatsky kept 33 volumes of a scrapbook of newspaper clippings and writings from that period, which was very useful, very interesting. Some of the research was done right here in Tompkins County, or near that. It was in Freeville. There is the Spiritualist Assembly Church, and every week during the summer they had, and maybe still do, had seances in which a medium would contact the spirit world for people who wish to get advice. They don't contact actual deceased relatives, but they do contact spirit guides who can give advice to people who need help with their lives.
Well, what do you think of this phenomenon? Have you sat in on a seance and actually
seen
this? I have
done. I've been to several of them. I think they're quite interesting. The mediums are, to some extent, act like therapists. They're able to sort of figure out what this person needs in their life. They're usually in some life crisis, and they need some advice. Sometimes it's very practical advice on, you know, whether they should go into partnership with their brother in a gas station, or it's personal advice about whether they should encourage their daughter to marry this guy she's going out with, or something like that. Mm-hmm. And the spirit guides through the medium give them advice. It's useful to people who believe in this.
Did you believe in it though?
Well, I don't really want to say.
I remember one of the most famous clairvoyants was Casey. What's his name?
Oh yes, Casey. I've read of some
Edgar
of his
Casey.
Things.
Yeah.
Edgar Casey.
Uh-huh.
He was very.
Yeah, my mom and my grandfather were really interested in him.
It never goes away. This stuff. It comes back. The more research I did, the more I realized how ubiquitous it is and has been through history.
It's I think it's people just wanting to believe, just like religion or anything else. Don't you agree?
Yeah, it came out of a 19th century desire for people to make a personal contact with the spirit world rather than through organized religion. This was the years when in Ithaca area, where it's called the burnt out region, and there were a lot of movements around here, the Oneonta, Oneida colony was the most famous, and they started a silver factory, which is still going. The Mormons got their start in Palmyra, and that's certainly still going. The rest of them faded away, but they came back in the 60s. There was the Yay God Commune in the 60s up in the hills, which turned into Wisdom's Goldenrod, some of the same people, and that's still going.
I find the subject very fascinating. Mm-hmm. Now, I also want to talk to you about the fact that you give workshops all over the world, and these are writing workshops, I assume.
Mm-hmm.
What do you teach, and who do you teach?
Well, there are workshops in the summer around the States, and I've done some of those. People come, mostly adults, who have been writing and are out of school and want somebody to read their work. And we give my wife and I, Allison Lurie, and I... have worked up various techniques of giving exercises, writing exercises, which people like. And then they read their work aloud, and they sort of critique each other in a positive way. And we've had a wonderful time doing these workshops. In Britain and in India, it's a rather new thing, creative writing, and they're eager to put it into their curriculums. I wrote a curriculum for the Loyola College in Madras, and then took it to the university in Kathmandu in Nepal, where I gave a workshop so they could incorporate it into their curriculum. They like the idea of creative writing, and they just haven't done it.
So it's a new idea, creative writing.
In that part of the world, yeah.
Oh. Mm-hmm. Oh. So I wonder how you'd have to teach somebody how to use their imagination, perhaps, huh?
You have to teach people to get away from the old British system of learning by rote. And just not just wait for the professor to give out wisdom, but to actually go into your own memory, your own creative parts of you, and let yourself do whatever you want and see how it comes out.
Mm-hmm.
Writing, like any of the arts, is going into unknown territory and seeing what you find there, and sometimes it isn't much, and sometimes it's something wonderful. And you can interpret your dreams, and you can do things like that. And sometimes you get good results. I just saw a wonderful video of a jazz photograph, a great day in Harlem. And one of the musicians says, I finally wrote down one of my dreams. It was the greatest thing. And the next morning, I started working on it, and it was Stardust.
Wow.
It was, he hadn't written it. He just remembered it from someplace else. Uh-huh. It wasn't much of anything. But, anyway, this is the sort of thing that you help people to, is get in touch with their subconscious, with their creative side of themselves, which mm-hmm. they may not have had a chance to use much in their daily lives. And people who come to these workshops are very grateful to have a chance to do this, and people pay attention to mm-hmm. this part of their lives, which they haven't had a chance to express to too many people.
Have you discovered any incredible talent so far?
Well, last summer we gave a workshop in Greece. Most of our students were British, and there was an Irish. There was an Irish guy who had become a millionaire in the computer business. He was only about 45, and he decided to retire and write full-time. He was really very, very talented. Mm. And I'm sure we'll hear from him.
How does this affect your own writing, though, when you're teaching people? Are you learning new things about yourself?
I sometimes do the exercises along with the students.
Do you?
And try and stick them into something I'm working on at the time. Yeah, I do that, and it's rather fun to do that.
Uh-huh. I know people have suggested, because you have traveled so much and you've had such an interesting life, that you write your autobiography. And you say you just can't. Well, why is that?
Well, because I'm a fiction writer. I want to make stuff up.
I know, but a lot of fiction writers write their autobiography.
I know, and they make it up, too.
that's a whole new controversy.
There's never been a memoir that's been completely true.
Oh, I'm sure.
Going back to, I don't know, Latin and to, you know, Benjamin Franklin's autobiography, that people make it up. I feel I've written a lot of my life in fiction already. I've touched on areas of my life. And I don't really want to go back and do it over again.
Yeah.
I want to do something new and fresh and interesting.
Uh-huh. And what subjects are coming up in Edward Hauer's repertoire? What did you say you were working on now?
I'm working on a novel which is set in Provincetown right now. Mm. I was there from 1980 to 81 as a fellow in the Fine Arts Work Center. It's about a singer and a painter, a man and a woman. I don't want to talk anymore about it. When a lot of writers don't like to talk about works in progress, because it's you want to keep it to yourself until it's on paper. Mm-hmm. You might get sort of spoiled if you talk about it.
You also said in your on your website that you write journalism too, besides uh-huh. fiction. What kind of stuff do you write? Letters
well,
to
I've
the
done
editor?
Travel journalism just for fun mostly. If I want to go someplace, like when I wanted to go back to India, I got paid, you know, nicely by the New York Times to do a travel article, and I also got paid by the Smithsonian Magazine. I paid for my whole journey essentially. When I wanted to go to Chile to research a book which I haven't written yet, I got New York Times to pay for that too, and so it's a way of paying for travel. And I do a lot of book reviews. It's a way of keeping your name up in front of the public for when your next book comes out.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sort of fun to read new books, and sometimes you discover wonderful new writers, which I have done. I reviewed The Kite Runner, which is on the New York Times bestseller list now. Nobody ever heard of the author. It was his first book, Khaled Hosseini. And I've been getting requests from a lot of different places to come and talk about the book, because it's such a wonderful phenomenon. So it's nice to keep in the current book world.
The culture of what's happening now. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's another thing I wanted to ask you. Who in the writing world has influenced you the most, besides Tennessee Williams?
Mm-hmm. Well, I started in, I think, liking John Steinbeck and James T. Farrell when I was very young, realistic novels. The Alexandrian Quartet,
wasn't that great, Lawrence Durrell?
Yeah, Lawrence yep. Durrell's book influenced
me. I love those,
a lot.
Too. Yep.
That was important to me. James Baldwin was important to me. And Salman Rushdie.
Uh-huh.
These were important books.
Well, we have run out of time, and I thank you so much for being with us, and we look forward to your next novel.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Our audio producer is Tim Reppert at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. We are a project of the Women's Interfaith Institute in Seneca Falls. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And log on to our new website at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.